It's Ideasphere with author Nell Bernstein, Burning Down the House.
We need to do more than stop doing this terrible thing to kids. We need to take some or all of the money that we're willing to spend to incarcerate a kid and invest that money in the tremendously under-resourced neighborhoods that many of the kids we lock up come from.
The U.S. incarcerates more of its young people than any other industrialized nation. The numbers are startling, but the costs are even more so. America spends $5 billion each year to keep its kids behind bars. That's almost $90,000 per youth per year. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices, with award-winning journalist and author Nell Bernstein. Her research has led to the book Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. Bernstein lets us into the hidden lives of incarcerated children. The stories she reveals are troubling evidence that the institution designed to protect and rehabilitate children has instead turned on them. Her previous work, Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated, earned her Newsweek's Book of the Week. Bernstein is a former Soros Justice Media Fellow in New York and winner of a White House Champion of Change Award. And she joins me for this program. Ms. Bernstein, thanks so much for taking this time.
I'm very glad to be here.
Your new work is a follow-up on the recent book, All Alone in the World, in which the story is of children with parents who are serving time in prison. I couldn't help but think the idea for this book, Burning Down the House, came while you were writing the first.
You know, I think both books came from the same original source, which was just a couple of decades of working with and befriending young people whose entire families sometimes were caught up in the criminal justice system. But yeah, they're absolutely two sides of the same coin.
This is something our country has had in place for 200 years, the juvenile incarceration, some kind of prison system for the youth. Yet we place nice euphemisms on facilities so that they sound more helpful than they really are. But in many cases, they're solitary confinement and imprisonment.
Yeah, that's right. Although the subtitle of the book is The End of Juvenile Prison, technically there's no such thing as a juvenile prison.
Right.
The ideology is reflected in euphemisms like academy or boys' school or, you know, sometimes the more generic facility. But when I went to see these places and saw the coils of razor wire and the sally port and the cells, which are not called cells, they're called rooms, there really was no other word to use.
What's going to be surprising to so many is what happens to our economy. So I'd like to spend some time on that before we get too involved in the rest of the story.
Mm-hmm.
It's costly?
It's immensely costly, depending on which way you look at it. It costs, on average, $88,000 a year to incarcerate a young person compared to an average of $10,000 to educate a child. In California, where I live, it got as high as $225,000 a year, mostly because of ongoing lawsuits against our youth authority and, probably not coincidentally, our education spending dropped to 8,000 and something. But there's a figure I saw recently that I think is even more telling, and I think it was the sort of total cost when you think of all the public systems involved and lost taxes and just sort of one of those very complex analyses, that locking a kid up ends up costing over $3 million in subsequent incarcerations and other negative outcomes.
It really, personally, it took me aback by the amount of money it takes, and especially in California.
And there are a couple other states that New York, I think, hit the 200,000 mark. I used to call incarceration the last standing entitlement.
No.
Because we were deciding that we couldn't afford welfare and food stamps and things like that, but we could afford to incarcerate people who committed welfare fraud because they couldn't feed their kids. But I think that has hit home, finally.
It seems so counterintuitive.
It does. I mean, counterintuitive to the point of being almost incomprehensible. But I think, paradoxically, that's where the good news starts. Our nation, you know, after a long upward climb in the number of juveniles we were incarcerating, has over the past decade or so experienced a 40% drop, which is quite significant. And there are a number of things driving that: a greater understanding of adolescent brain development, of the negative effects of incarceration, some very powerful advocates, countless scandals. But the main driver has been money. You know, as the states hit budget crises during the recession, they realized that this was unsustainable. So whatever you think of the motivation, the high cost actually turned out to be a boon in some ways.
So to whose interest is this current system working?
That's a very good question. It's not working in the best interest of the child, which is its mandate. In fact, being incarcerated as a juvenile is the best predictor that a kid will go on to be incarcerated as an adult. So it about doubles the chances. So it's not stemming delinquency. It's actually causing it to escalate into criminality. So not only does that go counter to the interest of the child, it's counter to all of our interest in public safety. Because if it's actually generating criminality, it's making us less safe. I know that there are some, and this includes many incarcerated people, who feel like, you know, with the introduction of private prisons, you know, it's in the interest of those who incarcerate. But the fact is that while there are some private prisons, it's still mostly taxpayers paying, or even when it's a private prison, paying the bill. So it's not in our interest. So that kind of leaves a mystery at the center of it. And I think that there's something that we get from incarceration that's fictional, but is psychologically comforting.
In your research, not only for the previous book, but now for Burning Down the House, you observe that many of the incarcerated youth also have a family member who's serving time.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I really struggled with in the first book. I think I started working on that one about 10 years ago, and there was essentially a false statistic circulating everywhere, including Congress grant proposals. I used it in the first draft, which was that a child with an incarcerated parent was six times more likely than the average child to become incarcerated himself. And finally, somebody more knowledgeable sat me down with a calculator and showed me that incarceration rates were so high that if this were true, we would be incarcerating more than 100% of all kids. And I met a lot of families where there was an incarcerated parent and, you know, one kid was incarcerated also and another was a successful mortgage broker. So I do try to be careful about not implying that having an incarcerated parent sort of predetermines your fate. Nevertheless, when I go into juvenile halls and ask how many kids have a family member who's incarcerated, well over half the hands do go up.
And going back to that euphemism mentioned before, the kind names used for institutions like this, once these children are released, these young people, reaching a level of responsible adulthood is even that much harder.
Yeah, that's another one of the terrible paradoxes, ironies of the whole situation is that, you know, if you think of the central tasks of adolescence, things like figuring out who you are, taking increased responsibility, learning how to take care of yourself, forming deeper relationships with others, functioning in the economy, educating yourself, those are all, you know, quite literally impossible inside a juvenile facility. And a lot of these places can take a kid, in my experience, as young as 10 and hold their wards, because prisoners is another word that's not used, until sometimes the age of 24, 25. So they enter as teenagers, leave as adults with all the expectations that brings with it, but none of the skills. and in fact, a set of skills that was adaptive inside a prison environment but is maladaptive on the outside.
Talking with journalist and author Nell Bernstein, her newest work, Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison, available from The New Press. Her previous work, All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. Ms. Bernstein, do you have a website, blog, tweet, or anything else you'd recommend?
Yes, this book has dragged me into the 21st century. My website is nellbernstein.com, and I have actually a somewhat more active Facebook page. And if you just put Burning Down the House into Facebook, that will show up.
Okay.
And I also have a Twitter account under my own name.
Okay. Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. This program is available on Public Radio Exchange, where you can hear it at your convenience under Ideasphere, or go to National Public Radio's podcasts, npr.org. Turning this to the personal side, while reading your book, I could not help but feel the pain you must have experienced during your research.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't, the research was definitely difficult, but I think even more difficult was seeing young people I had been close to during the decade I spent editing a youth newspaper go through this system and, you know, quite often come out profoundly traumatized and in some cases really never recover. But, you know, I don't really like to dwell on that. I went to visit a New York State juvenile facility early in my reporting, and they neglected to tell me that most of the facility was quarantined because there had been an outbreak of norovirus, which, you know, is sort of a really terrible intestinal ailment that you tend to get in prisons, nursing homes, and on cruise ships. So they only let me speak with a small group of kids who hadn't been quarantined, who were kind enough to make me lunch. But of course, I came down with norovirus and spent a week alone in a hotel room in New York, so sick that, poor me, I had to order Sprite from room service because I couldn't walk down the hall. And at the height of my self-pity, I thought, you know, here's this building full of kids going through this same really quite agonizing illness, and nobody is bringing them Sprite on a silver tray. In fact, you know, I'm not even sure they're allowed to get up and use the bathroom. And that really brought home to me how much the travails of daily life are exacerbated by incarceration. And this was actually a good facility where a major reform effort was underway.
Serendipitously, while I was preparing for our interview and reading your book, I ran across a newspaper article that dwelled on the inhumanity of solitary confinement. This made the news. It seems like it would be obvious, but the report is the result of studies conducted on adults. Children are frequently treated the same way. They're given the same lack of respect and, when deemed necessary, placed in solitary confinement.
You know, I could probably count on one hand the number of young people I interviewed who had not been placed in solitary confinement. The statistics, I think, you know, say that maybe a third experience it. But again, the euphemisms make it very hard to keep track. Administrative segregation, protective custody, or my personal favorite, reflection cottages. But you can get placed in solitary confinement in a juvenile facility for talking about suicide, even though a disproportionate number of suicides take place in solitary confinement. You can get placed there as a consequence for assaulting another kid. You can get placed there for being the victim of that assault. Kids are kept in the equivalent of solitary confinement, locked in their room around the clock, because there's a shortage of teachers. It's just ubiquitous, despite the fact that the United Nations and other bodies have declared it torture to keep a kid in solitary for any amount of time.
One such case that was very personal for you, a young woman you befriended, the system completely ignored her pleas, not to mention what you saw as her potential.
I think you're talking about Eliza.
Yes.
Yeah, and that, you know, when I talked about the hardest part being the kids I knew, she's probably the most heartbreaking example of that. She started writing for us at 14 or so. Brilliant. I mean, just happened to be a brilliant girl who had been in, well, she lost count, but she thinks about 40 foster homes and group homes since the state took her from her great-grandmother's home at 11 because they thought her great-grandma was too old to care for her. So she was, her crime essentially was being parentless and not being able to deal with the rigors of group home life, which I could sympathize with because I worked in one briefly and I couldn't take it either. But I was allowed to leave, not just at the end of my shift, but I quit after not a very long period. So she was locked up for 6 months at one point for running from a group home, but never got into serious trouble until she decided to go to college. She turned 18, which meant that she thought she was no longer a fugitive for the crime of taking care of herself. And I remember her calling after she had enrolled in college and reading me the course catalog, and she was so excited. She called back a few days later and said that the financial aid officer had discovered that she had an outstanding warrant from the group home days. And she'd been told that until she cleared that warrant, she couldn't get any financial aid, which precluded her from being able to go to college. So to clear the warrant, they wanted her to spend 3 days in county jail, which she did. And she didn't think it was going to be that big a deal. But how do I put it? She had a face that launched 1,000 fights. She just didn't take anybody's guff and wasn't really interested in the hierarchy of the dorm. And she got in a fight. She had suffered so much abuse during her life that when she did get in a fight, it was very hard for her to stop. And I think it was hard for the guards to break it up. And that may be why they did what they did, which was strip her naked and place her not only in solitary confinement, but in something called a cold cell, which if people have heard of it at all, they've probably heard of it as a technique that the CIA uses to break down terrorism suspects. It's a tiled, completely empty cell with just a drain in the floor and the temperature intentionally lowered. You're placed in there naked. And she lost it in there and just could not stop screaming. And they kept telling her, you know, we'll let you out when you stop screaming, but she couldn't. And finally, after I don't know how long, but a matter of days, they had somebody come down and sedate her, and then they released her. And it turned out, she told me later, that she had requisitioned her child welfare file after she turned 18 and learned that as an infant, she had been found on more than one occasion naked and abandoned in her crib, sometimes for days, because her mother had gone out to score drugs. And she told me that in the cold cell, she regressed. And that feeling of being naked, captive, alone, unheard, just sort of descended upon her. And honestly, she was never the same. She didn't go to college. She's really struggled. The tremendous energy and just sort of giftedness that she had has leached out of her. And that was one of the worst things I think that I saw happen.
Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison by Nell Bernstein. You can see more of her work on her website, nellbernstein.com, or burningdownthehouseblog.com. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rothbun. We'll be right back. You're back with Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices, with journalist and author Nell Bernstein, Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. One of the remarkable discoveries you made is how imprisoned youth, despite the daunting hurdles, somehow maintain hope. In your interviews, they expressed optimism that they would somehow overcome the obstacles and continue their education. Yet, there is the self-esteem that's been so damaged.
Yeah, but it's true that that was one of the surprises of the research, was that the great majority of kids wanted and expected to go to college, to form families, to have careers. And I think, you know, there's a misconception that, oh, you know, these kind of kids, it's nothing for them to be locked up. They're used to it. It's a rite of passage, etc. But that's really not the case. They have all the same aspirations that any kid does. And sometimes I think, well, some young people said this, that even worse than entering prison was coming back out and discovering that there were a second set of invisible walls on the outside, barring them from accessing education and employment and housing and sort of branding them for life.
An element that factors in with youth incarceration is the proverbial subordinateness and superior. You're going to see abuse, mental and physical. The statistics spell out the story, yet we act as though nothing can be done to change it.
You know, there's a sense in which that's true, but I think what we do that's even worse is we act as if something can be done to change it. The stories of physical and sexual abuse, 1 in 10 kids, for example, according to official research, has been sexually assaulted by a guard. This stuff has been happening since before the dawn of the juvenile court. The very first houses of refuge reported, you know, horrific discipline, the ducking stool and things like that. And so to me, I think what's really naive or maybe even intentionally blind is, given the hundreds or thousands of reform efforts that we've been through over these two centuries, to think that in an environment that is hidden from the public and has this double disparity in power of adult to child and guard to prisoner, this kind of abuse actually can be prevented.
You ask a very good question toward the end of your book, and perhaps we can go there now. You ask, what if we spent each dollar we would otherwise have spent on incarceration to invest in the future of the child?
Mm-hmm. And I should say, I'm certainly not the first to ask that. The notion that people are calling justice reinvestment, which means we need to do more than stop doing this terrible thing to kids. We need to take some or all of the money that we're willing to spend to incarcerate a kid and invest that money in the tremendously under-resourced neighborhoods that many of the kids we lock up come from. And, you know, I asked kids a lot of questions about what rehabilitated them, for lack of a better word. But I also asked them what dehabilitated them. When and how did things go wrong? And they always pointed to, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, some kind of a loss in the family, whether it's a dad going to prison or a grandmother dying, some kind of loss and no safety net. You know, something as simple as a basketball court or a functioning school or a rec center. So, yeah, I do think that we not only need to stop damaging these young people, we need to start seeing them as the asset that they are.
Trust. That's a key you found in your research. And paraphrasing what you said is, every kid needs to have a trusting relationship with an adult.
Yeah. I mean, again, when I asked them, how did you make it? Mm-hmm. Those who did could always point to at least one relationship that was unconditional, long-term, reciprocal, and trusting. And again, this is not just me. All the research on resilience, for example, points to the same thing, which makes it, again, so counterintuitive that when young people, you know, because you hear, oh, he's just doing it for attention. Yeah, a lot of them are doing it for attention. And instead of giving them that attention, we remove all their natural relationships, replace them with relationships that are at best indifferent and often hostile, and then somehow expect them to do better. It kind of it goes against all the research, but it also goes against what we know as parents, as humans, just from basic common sense.
Quoting from one person you give several examples of in this book, he's or was a Massachusetts juvenile department official, Jerry Miller, and he says anything, including nothing, was better than these institutions.
Yeah, it's funny. And he acted on his word. He was, in the 70s, he was made head of the Massachusetts system and kind of in the same way I did, went in with the idea that he was going to clean them up and reform them and make them therapeutic. Not, I didn't go in thinking I would do this, but that I would suggest that others do it. And discovered so much resistance, not least of all from his own staff, that he actually did shut down all of the institutions in the state of Massachusetts. And it's interesting that you bring him up because he also said that, you know, sort of the definition of doing right by children would be to take the money we spent to incarcerate them and make sure that every dollar was invested in that child instead.
Enough to send them through a university.
Well, you know, it's funny, Eliza said that. She said they could have sent me to Harvard for what they spent to lock me up.
Ms. Bernstein, thank you so much for your time. I sincerely appreciate this, and your work is admirable.
Thank you very much.
I hope we have a chance to speak again.
I would enjoy that very much. Thank you for taking the time to do it again.
Absolutely. Without question. Take care.
Thanks.
I've been talking with journalist and author Nell Bernstein. Her book, Burning Down the House. Check out our website at nellbernstein.com or burningdownthehouseblog.com. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for this program, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.